Our connection now is made in President Joe Biden's first speech on foreign policy. How would he address Russia? Biden hit that point early on. He said, quote, "I made it clear to President Putin in a matter very different from my predecessor that the days of the United States rolling over in the face of Russia's aggressive actions are over," end quote. The BBC said that it was the starkest of contrasts with President Trump, who seemed to go out of his way to avoid criticizing the Russian president. There was a lot for President Biden to cover with regards to Russia. As the BBC noted, he nodded to the value of engaging with Moscow on areas of mutual interest, such as preventing nuclear war. The two leaders have just agreed to extend their last remaining arms control treaty. But he pledged to hold Vladimir Putin to account on cyber attacks, election interference, and he called for the release of the Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny. President Trump, of course, spoke about Putin in glowing terms almost always, so this is a contrast. But how can the new president make sure his public statements will be matched by action? Our guest has decades of experience on these matters, and we welcome back to the program Randy Stone, director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Professor Stone, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Evan.
Let me just start by asking, you agree with the BBC assessment that the first signs are a very stark contrast, president to president?
That's right. And I'd say it's a refreshing change. The previous administration was completely ineffective in dealing with Russia. And so it's made things difficult for Biden. He has to work extra hard to reestablish kind of a modicum of reasonable behavior on Putin's side.
Now, I'm going to go down just sort of a list of things that stand out to me in no sort of particular order, but let me start with Alexei Navalny. For listeners who are not as familiar, or maybe just heard, maybe perhaps reporting on NPR for a little while on this story, remind listeners who Alexei Navalny is and the significance of this case.
Well, Alexei Navalny has become the most prominent sort of dissident critic of Putin's regime. He was kind of a gadfly for years, and he did exposés of corruption in high places in Russia, and some of them, you know, based on his own investigative reporting, and some of them were quite unveiled some lurid corruption. He kind of rose to prominence in 2011 during the protests at Bolotnaya Площadь in Moscow, when Putin decided to switch places again with Dmitry Medvedev and reassume the presidency of Russia. And he's been sort of an important figure since then. Well, most recently, he was poisoned, evidently by the Russian secret services, and got sick while he was on an airplane, had to be evacuated to Germany. Was shown that the poison that he received was Novichok, which is a deadly nerve agent developed by the Soviet Union and not possessed by anyone but Russian secret service. So it was kind of Putin's way of writing his signature on an assassination attempt. He decided to return to Russia, remarkably, and knew that he would be arrested at the airport when he returned. He was arrested. What he was charged with, ironically, was violation of parole, because he had been imprisoned on some trumped-up charges and given a suspended sentence with a need to come in for parole and speak to a parole officer twice a week. Of course, he couldn't do that while he was in a coma because he'd been poisoned. And so that was the charge that they used to sentence him to 2 years in prison.
He said before he went back to Russia that he knew he would be arrested and that this was something that he had to do to essentially make a statement for future Alexei Navalny's who want to be whistleblowers or at least those who push the regime. But when you say, to be clear, Randy, when you say that the poison had an almost signature from Putin, is there any doubt that Putin knew about this or authorized it?
No, I don't think there's any doubt at all. I mean, I think the only reason you use something that's so readily identifiable is because you want to make it clear that you pulled the trigger.
And so now, when President Biden makes a demand that Navalny be released, I mean, he must know that that's not going to be met with any approval, but it is an important international gesture. How important do you think this Navalny case is? Does it strain relations at all? Could it chill the future people like Alexei Navalny? I mean, how is this going over? Because there's reporting on, frankly, very brave protests happening. Can you kind of give me the scope of international reaction from heads of state to the people of Russia on how this is all being taken?
Well, I think it's the U.S. president signaling that we don't approve and don't condone this kind of behavior is symbolically important. And sets an important tone of leadership, which then makes it easier for our allies to move in the same direction. And so I think that's all terribly important. I don't think it's going to lead to Navalny's release. That would be a very surprising outcome. But that's not usually what you expect when you express disapproval of sort of grave human rights abuses like this. You know, Navalny, I think, really got the last word here, because he was reported as saying when he was being arraigned in court, you know, that you know, the poison was apparently applied to his underclothes. It's a contact poison. And he said, you know, well, now, you know, we had Alexander the Liberator, speaking of the czar who liberated the serfs. We had Yaroslav the Wise. Now we have Vladimir the Poisoner of Underpants. And it's a way of kind of using humor, and I think a very politically significant way. But the protests have poured out in Russia. They had to arrest 10,000 people last weekend. They would start in the Far East. They would spread all across the country. They would be massive in Moscow and St. Petersburg. So I think there's widespread dissatisfaction with the regime, and it's being catalyzed by this, by really disgust at the regime that would stoop to poisoning a dissident. Is it likely to lead to a change of regime? No, it's not likely to.
No. But, and this may be an obvious point, but I just want to emphasize this. From my perspective, when you see these kinds of protests in a place like Russia, and what is being reported in various quarters as some of the fiercest crackdown from the Kremlin in years, mm-hmm. I just have to admire the bravery and the courage of the protesters to do this, because this is not like protesting on the streets of the United States. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yes. There have been a lot of cases of brutal beatings and a lot of abuse that's been exerted by the police. It hasn't apparently been nearly as brutal as the crackdown that's continuing to go on in Belarus. But that's the context here, that Putin is very nervous about democracy movements, and he's seen so pro-democracy movements and protests lead to regime change now twice in Ukraine. And all fall, it was kind of on the edge in Belarus which way it was going to go after Lukashenko stole the election in August. And they have ongoing street protests on a continuous basis in Belarus. And Belarus would have seemed like the dictatorship in the former Soviet Union that was the most locked down up until this fall. So it's kind of remarkable. And I think this is what's behind the concern here. And frankly, this nervousness about democracy, that democracy anywhere is a threat to dictators everywhere, is essentially Putin's view, goes a long way to explaining why it was so difficult for the Obama administration to get along with Putin, even though they tried, and why it's going to be so difficult for the Biden administration, too.
Well, this week there was set to be an expiration of New START. It's the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, and there's an extension now. What's going on there, and what's the significance of this?
Well, this was the most important achievement of the Obama administration with Russia, was to get the New START Treaty negotiated. And it dramatically reduced arms strategic nuclear arms arsenals on both sides to 1,550 warheads and 800 launchers. So it cut them about in half from the size they had been under the previous agreement, which had cut them about in half from what they'd been in before. So if you start, you know, before the Gorbachev era, each side had about 10,000 warheads. And that was a sufficient nuclear force that if they'd all been fired off at random targets around the world, it probably would have wiped out all human life on the planet. And there were questions about, you know, whether even mammals would survive worldwide under that sort of scenario. It's categorically different at this level of armament. If you fired all those missiles and dropped all those bombs, you would still wipe out civilization, but it would be the worst event in human history, but it wouldn't be the last event in human history. So I think that's categorically different and really, really an important accomplishment. So it was kind of scary that, you know, if Trump had been reelected, he was planning to let it expire. It would have expired today. And that would have presumably set off another round of arms race. Now, both sides, Putin didn't want an arms race. He can't afford an arms race, and doesn't want to invest his resources that way and so forth. He was eager to sign this extension, but he would have, I think, felt impelled to engage in an arms race if the thing had expired. So it's very important. It's good timing, actually, that this had to be done right away, so it couldn't hold up Biden's future steps to make Russia a little bit more accountable. Right? If the timing had been different, there would have been a lot of concern that, well, we can't really impose new sanctions on Russia or rally our allies to be tougher against Russia because we have to renew the New START. But this timing right at the beginning of the administration, I think, is actually fortuitous.
I want to get to cyber attacks on infrastructure in a moment. But just real briefly, who's most in charge with these kind of negotiations? Is Tony Blinken a central figure? Is it the president himself, given his experience? I mean, who do you see as central?
I think Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State, has Biden's complete trust. He's worked with him for, I think, over 20 years. In his speech yesterday, Biden said, foreign leaders know that, you know, you speak for me, after Anthony Blinken introduced him at the State Department. So I think he's the one who is very much going to be taking the lead on this, and he has his Biden's support, but so he knows what Biden thinks on these things. Biden is going to want to be tougher. I think he's going to want to hold Russia accountable for manipulating the 2016 election in the United States. There hasn't been much talk about the fact that Russia also intervened in the Brexit vote and was on the pro-Brexit side, incidentally. They've had a worldwide influence campaign. They intervened in the French presidential election. And then this most recent cyber attack, the SolarWinds cyber attack, which was of unprecedented scale. We still don't know the size of it.
Can you explain that briefly for those of us who really struggle to understand, how to contextualize this?
The SolarWinds event?
Yeah.
So this was we're just getting bits and pieces right now, and I think that the first step that the administration will take on Russia will be to do a very systematic report on it, report probably to Congress about it, and then announce some very serious consequences after having dealt multilaterally with our allies. So I think it will be a little while before we hear all the details. But what we've heard so far is that about 1,000 Russian computer scientists were working under, we don't know which agency, whether it was the FSB or the GRU, one of the intelligence agencies, to compromise a company called SolarWinds, which provides operating systems for lots of computer servers in government and in business. Their effort was presumably to embed tools there, which would allow them to create backdoors to then get classified information, to get compromising information on individuals and so forth throughout the country. We don't know exactly what they were after or exactly what they got, but we do know that government and business systems were compromised all over the country. And so it's a very serious matter, I think, and it represents a kind of devil-may-care attitude, or a kind of a dare to the United States, that, you know, we can attack your crucial assets, and you can't do anything about it. So I think the United States kind of has to respond in order to prevent more of these kinds of events in the future. The timing, while Trump was still in office, which made it harder for the United States to respond, I think is not surprising.
Well, Peter in Rochester called in to ask, what are we going to find out about Russia and Trump as time goes on? Are there questions that need investigating in your mind on that front, Randy?
Well, I think we probably will find out more. I think we're probably not going to get a flood of that sort of information until after the impeachment is over and so forth in the Senate. I think that the administration is probably not going to rush to bring that sort of thing out, but as part of its systematic response to Russian espionage, that kind of thing has got to come out. And we're pretty sure that at this point that Putin had compromising material on Trump. We know what some of it was. We probably don't know all of it. I think that's going to come into the public eye sooner or later.
Well, and I was going to ask you as we get ready to wrap in our next few minutes here. It seemed to untrained observers that Putin viewed Trump as sort of a facile, easily manipulatable, sort of quasi ally. Whereas, it's going to be a different disposition with Joe Biden, and they have known each other for a number of years. And Biden's a bit of a blusterer, but he also has spent many years trying to cultivate relationships internationally. So I am curious to know how you see the disposition changing and what fruit you think it might bear. Also, perhaps in relation to the fact that there are still questions about meddling, not just in U.S. infrastructure cyber attacks, but I know there are still ongoing questions about election meddling. I'm not sitting here making the claim that every election has been stolen, but there are certainly some nefarious actors who seek to influence. So how do you view those questions, Professor Stone?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that U.S.-Russian relations are going to have to get somewhat worse before they can get better. We're kind of unfortunately in a position, this is inefficient for everyone, but at this point, Russian misbehavior has been so bad for so long that they have to be forced to pay a price, otherwise the United States just loses all credibility going forward. This is the first administration that has not started out with a plan to improve relations with Russia, and that's not the objective. I think that they're very clear that relations with Russia are chilly, and they should be, and probably they should get chillier, Russia needs to be systematically confronted and contained for a while. He didn't actually use the word containment yesterday, but we're just about at that point. He left open the possibility that there will be some engagement when it's consistent with our interests, on particular points. But the objective is not to improve the environment in the near future.
And lastly, in our last minute, just a question from a listener about bounties on U.S. soldiers. Anything we should be following there?
Well, this will be part of this sort of comprehensive assessment of Russia's misbehavior. Evidently, they were paying bounties for killing U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. It's a far cry from, you know, a few years back under the restart. Russia was glad that we were in Afghanistan and was supporting our effort in Afghanistan. But Putin's policy is kind of opportunistic, and he saw a vulnerability there and decided to push at it. I think this is one of many things. This is a reversion to Cold War sort of adversary behavior that Putin has engaged in, we can understand why. Right? He feels very threatened about democracy movements. He feels that he got his nose bloodied in Ukraine. He's trying to exploit whatever kind of leverage he can. But this is something that, you know, the new administration is going to be confronting.
Professor Stone, we're used to seeing you here in studio, and it's been a while. I do look forward to when we can do that again, but I am always grateful for your time and expertise. Thanks for making it for the program today, and I do hope we can talk soon.
Thanks, Evan. It's a pleasure, as always.
That's the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester, Randy Stone, the man who we think sort of knows everything but has no ego to go with it. Really amazing person. More connections coming up in a moment.